Hi, this is Allison, one of the producers here at On My Mind. Diane is out for a voice treatment, so we're bringing you something from her archives. Over the years, Diane interviewed poet laureates. She discussed specific poems and asked why poetry still matters. April is National Poetry Month, so it seemed like the perfect time to go back and listen to one of these shows. We selected her 2015 Reader's Review of Brown Girl Dreaming, a memoir in verse by Jacqueline Woodson, which won the National Book Award. The book of poems tell Woodson's story of growing up in South Carolina and New York City, and her developing awareness of race. Diane discussed the story with Dana Williams, professor at Howard University, Jamel Bowie, columnist at the New York Times, and David Orr, author of Beautiful and Pointless, A Guide to Modern Poetry.
First, David, explain to us a little bit about the structure of this book. I confess, it's the first memoir in verse that I have ever read.
And one of the very few that I've read as well. This book it's a roughly 320-page book composed of a series of relatively short poems, most of them, you know, a page, 2 pages, largely in free verse, although there is an exception that I want to talk about in a little bit. And the poems have their own individual titles. For instance, just turning the page here, one is called When I Tell My Family. And there are a few poems that are sequenced. So go up After Greenville and then After Greenville number 2. And then there's a long series of poems, 10 poems, I think, that are quite short that are called How to Listen. And Jacqueline Woodson uses those poems to kind of pace the book. You'll have these longer poems that tell a story about moving from one place to another. And then you'll have a quite short poem that just captures an idea.
What do you think the structure?
I actually love the little poems. So there are about 10 of them, and there's How to Listen number 1, How to Listen number 2, and so on and so forth. What's great about these little poems is that they're all haikus.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, haiku is a Japanese form, but it's also one of the great American forms at this point. It's the form that everybody uses when they're 7 years old or 8 years old. So let me just sort of single one out. How to Listen number 3. And she's writing about her grandfather, who you discover over the course of the book is getting sicker and sicker and dying, seems possibly dying of lung cancer. And here's the poem. Middle of the night, my grandfather is coughing me upright, startled. So she breaks the line between my grandfather is coughing and then the two words, me upright. So you're expecting her to say my grandfather is coughing and very sick or something, but instead he's coughing her upright. And it really does a nice job of just conveying how the illness of a relative, when it's suddenly brought to bear on us, startles us. And she leaves startled as its own word too. So they're very skillfully done.
Indeed.
But what I think is especially interesting is that you have this series of poems that paces the book. And then you get all the way to page 244, which is not listed as part of the sequence. And it's called PS 106 Haiku. And the haiku in its entirety is Jacqueline Woodson, I'm finally in fourth grade. It's raining outside.
I love it.
Which I hope is an actual haiku that she wrote in fourth grade.
Yeah, exactly. Dana Williams, read for us that very first poem titled February 12th. 1963.
I am born on a Tuesday at University Hospital, Columbus, Ohio, USA, a country caught between black and white. I'm born not long from the time or far from the place where my great-great-grandparents worked the deep, rich land unfree, dawn till dusk, unpaid, drank cool water from scooped-out gourds, looked up and followed the sky's mirrored constellation to freedom. I am born as the South explodes. Too many people, too many years. Enslaved, then emancipated, but not free. The people who look like me keep fighting and marching and getting killed so that today, February 12th, 1963, and every day from this moment on, brown children like me can grow up free, can grow up learning and voting and walking and riding wherever we want. I am born in Ohio, but the stories of South Carolina already run like rivers through my veins.
It's an incredible poem because it's both personal and universal.
Yes. I also think that it's relevant in so many small ways as well. So she situates like her coming into the world in the same way that it frames the narrative, right? So here is this narrative. And here is this Jacqueline who,
here,
you know,
am I.
Yes. And we learn a couple of poems later that she gets saved from being named Jack. So here comes Jacqueline, right?
And why was she almost named Jack?
Because her father's name was Jack. And that is what he insisted on naming her. And I thought that that was like really funny. My sister's name is Tommy.
Oh,
because my father's name is Thomas.
How interesting.
And it was a concession, I think, between my mother and my father. So I really liked a girl named Jack. And so her father tells her, name a girl Jack, my father said, and she can't help but to grow up strong. Because she'll have to defend herself,
exactly.
Essentially, of course. And so her mother wins that war and says, not even Jackie, because people might decide to drop the IE.
Exactly.
She's Jacqueline.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Jamel, why do you think that Jacqueline Woodson chose to write this memoir in verse?
My hunch, and, you know, I don't read a lot of poetry, so this is very much kind of a layman's hunch, is that there's something, especially reading something from the perspective of a kid and thinking about childhood memory and thinking about how when we remember our childhoods, it's very rarely in terms of explicit narrative. It's more in terms of impressions, in terms of scattered memories, of slices of memory, of smells, of feelings. And I think poetry is an excellent vehicle for doing that. And so just the structure of the book, I think, really reflects what it's both like to remember being a kid, and also I think what it's like to be a kid, where the world is very new and where things, events, experiences hit you in this very big way throughout your childhood.
I agree. And we've already got a Facebook comment from Joni. I saw this book on display in the library at the Eric Carle Museum on a recent visit. I'm thinking it's another book described as for middle grades, when in fact it's for all of us. I'm 62. What do your guest reviewers think, Dana?
I'm excited that the book is accessible across ages, for young readers and for more mature readers. It's an interesting kind of complicated thing, though, because I can remember one of my sisters saying, you know, Jacqueline Woodson's at the Arkansas local library and she's signing books and I want to get it for my niece or my cousin, actually, who is 12, maybe 13. And she had some concerns about, you know, will her mother let her read it? Because it has so many really complicated things about race and racism and oppression. So I thought that it was especially good because it was a good opportunity to introduce children to these stories in a safe way, but then also in a very straightforward, remembered way that's structured in a way that allows you to have these interesting conversations.
And what you're saying is that she worried that the child might somehow then think of herself differently?
Yes. In part because we don't have, I mean, we have to remember that children aren't growing up in the spaces that we grew up in, right? So not in the same kind of way. I was born in 72, so I'm not all that old, but I also grew up in a predominantly Black town where you didn't have to have certain kinds of conversations. They were understood and not in a discriminatory way. The town was primarily Black, so the way that we thought about race had nothing to do with an engagement with a textbook, which was probably more wrong than right in most instances.
The extraordinary brevity and conciseness of each poem really amazed me, and because it gave me so much information about her, about the feeling she had, both as a child being reared in a family that's very strongly identified with Jehovah's Witness, and she, as a child, is required to go from home to home, mm-hmm. selling the Watchtower magazine. And she describes all that in such a way that it becomes extraordinarily powerful, whereas had she written paragraphs and paragraphs about it, somehow it might have diluted the experience.
I agree. I think the poem, What I Believe, is probably the most emblematic of that for me. When she says, I believe in God and evolution. I believe in the Bible and the Quran. I believe in Christmas and the New World. I believe that there is good in each of us, no matter who we are or what we believe in. I believe in the words of my grandfather. I believe in the city and the South and the past and the present. I believe in Black people and white people coming together. I believe in nonviolence and power to the people. I believe in my little brother's pale skin and my own dark brown. I believe in my sister's brilliance and the two easy books I love to read. I believe in my mother on a bus and Black people refusing to ride. I believe in good friends and good food. I believe in Johnny Pumps and Jump Ropes, Malcolm and Martin, Buckeyes and Birmingham, writing and listening, bad words and good words. I believe in Brooklyn. I believe in one day and someday and this perfect moment called now. There's so much in that poem.
So much in that poem.
And the poem comes late in the book when she's really figured out what she does believe. And also the end of the poem, the perfect moment called now. I mean, so much lyric poetry is about the perfect moment called now, whether the now is wonderful or horrifying or just concerning in some way.
But being in that
moment. In that moment, exactly.
Now a quick break.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter. Here's the rest of Diane's conversation about Brown Girl Dreaming, a memoir in verse by Jacqueline Woodson.
The one part that I missed was the anguish that she must have felt leaving her grandparents' home and having to move to New York because her mother and father do not have a relationship, and she feels she's got to move north.
Mm-hmm. One thing, though, that I liked about this book is that she is happy to underplay sometimes. And to when you think the book is going to be sentimental, she backs away from it. There's a really great sequence where she's talking about one of their neighbors in Greenville who, as she puts it, has a hole in his heart, this little boy that they're going to play with, but they can't play too roughly with him. And, you know, she has this conversation with the little boy. And of course, the stage is set for sentimentality because there's this very sick kid and they're all in the neighborhood together. And she's telling him about New York. And the little kid says, well, I'm going to go to New York one day. And then he points his arm in the direction. And a much more sentimental author would have just ended the poem there. But then she continues it for the next line where they correct him and say, no, actually, you're pointing south, New York's the other way.
I love the image of her friend, Maria. Mm-hmm. And at one point, a third friend joins them, and Jacqueline becomes a little insecure in the process because she kind of feels as though she's going to be the third person out. But then it changes.
Well, she realizes how important it is to find home outside of a home space. So she has quite a few poems where she talks about her mother reuniting with people who are from the South, right? So she says, this is home for my mother. She recognizes that because this little girl has parents who are Puerto Rican, that the very thing that her mother found as home in people who were from the same place that Maria might find, but Maria assures her quickly, this doesn't mean she'll be my new best friend. So she feels comfortable, I think. And then also, we see her sense of courage from one of those early poems, It'll Be Scary Sometimes. And whoever is narrating that particular poem tells her, listen, it'll be scary. Sometimes you'll be the only Black person in the room. Sometimes you'll be the new person. Sometimes you'll be the outsider. It'll be scary sometimes, but always remember your grandfather. So there's this direct line connection. It's not just a fairy tale. Remember like some heroic figure. No, this is your bloodline. Remember your grandfather. It'll be scary sometimes, but you'll be fine.
There is that wonderful poem on 311, which is fairly long, David, but I'd really like you to read it because I think it says a lot about Jacqueline.
Sure, I'd be happy to. It's called A Writer. You're a writer, Ms. Vivo says, her gray eyes bright behind thin wire frames, her smile bigger than anything. So I smile back, happy to hear these words from a teacher's mouth. She is a feminist, she tells us, and 30 fifth grade hands bend into desks where our dictionaries wait to open yet another world to us. Miss Vivo pauses, watches our fingers fly. Webster's has our answers. Equal rights, a boy named Andrew yells out, for women. My hands freeze on the thin, white pages. Like blacks, Ms. Vivo, too, is part of a revolution. But right now, that revolution is so far away from me. This moment, this here, this right now, is my teacher saying, "You're a writer," as she holds the poem I am just beginning. The first four lines stolen from my sister. Black brothers, black sisters, all of them were great. No fear, no fright, but a willingness to fight. You can have them, Dell said when she saw. I don't want to be a poet. And then my own pencil moving late into the evening. In big fine houses lived the whites. In little old shacks lived the blacks. But the blacks were smart. In fear, they took no part. One of them was Martin, with a heart of gold. You're a writer, Ms. Vivo says, holding my poem out to me. And standing in front of the class, taking my poem from her, my voice shakes as I recite the first line. Black brothers, black sisters, all of them were great. But my voice grows stronger with each word because more than anything else in the world, I want to believe her.
You know, a large part of the poem you just read, David, and it seems to me a fair amount of the book itself deals with her growing awareness of the civil rights conflict and movement. Jamel, you were part of that. Exactly.
Yes, and it's interesting. Earlier in the conversation, we talked a bit about the book dealing with race in this sort of sophisticated but way that is friendly to younger readers and that they can understand. I grew up in the 90s. I was a little kid in the 90s. And I grew up in a largely white area. And my awareness of race didn't come to me like it came to me like hers did and not like hers did. I mean, obviously, growing up in the 60s and the 70s is going to be very different. But sort of seeing and realizing that other people view you differently and are treating you differently, and that kind of growing awareness as you know, when you're a little kid, as you become a slightly older kid, as you move into middle school, and kind of really coming to terms with what that means is something that she describes and experiences. And it's something, you know, in a different form, my experience. And I actually think a book like this would have been tremendously helpful to me as like a 9-year-old.
Interesting.
It is difficult to explain that what you are experiencing to like a 9-year-old kid in that kind of situation without scaring them about sort of what that might mean, and without making them feel as if some possibilities in their lives are closed off. And one thing that this book does extremely well is not do that, is to provide some sort of context and some sort of explanation and some sort of guidance that really does emphasize the weightiness of it all, but doesn't close off sort of like the
possibility.
Yeah.
And that goes back to your friend's feeling about giving the book to the niece and whether, in fact, that would somehow expose her to feelings, ideas, experiences that otherwise she might not have had.
Or that she wouldn't have until a little bit later. I think that tends to be the fear, that it's too soon to talk to kids about something. But all of the research suggests that kids are aware of race and difference in ways that we want to pretend that they're not. So it's important to have a text that you can give to them that introduces them to these ideas in ways that don't just focus on the difficulty, but focus on what's possible.
Right.
And focus on the idea of change and help us to understand how you overcome obstacles. because the things that she goes through that aren't specifically about race are so relatable that the kid will remember inevitably to go back to that text to say, here's a point of reference for me that I can begin to think about what it means to have people marching in the streets, for instance, right now, and why it's important to be active but thoughtful about the way that we engage
and
difficulties.
That takes me to those few poems written about how we listen.
Mm-hmm.
David,
mm-hmm.
You've thought a lot about how we listen, but they play a big role in the book. There are 10
That's
how
right.
to listen poems. First is on page 20. There are lots of them.
Right. And they chart her growth as a writer and as a person. Jamel was saying earlier that he feels that poetry really works in this book because it helps to capture the fragmentary nature of childhood. Am I getting that right, Jamel?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I agree with you. I think that's a great point. We think of poetry, and I'm not saying this is how poetry is, but it's how people think of it, as being intensely personal and intensely emotional. So when you're working on a novel like this, that's a young adult novel in verse, you're really talking about a self that's forming as opposed to a self that's already formed, as you might see in a novel intended for adults. And so that I think that's one of the reasons that poetry works so well here, or seems to work so well for so many readers. And these How to Listen poems really do chart that development, that very slow development, and also comment sort of gracefully on some of the social issues in the book as well. On page 82, you have How to Listen number 2. In the stores downtown, we're always followed around just because we're brown. One of the few rhyming poems in the book, and I would say it's probably sort of a hat tip to Gwendolyn Brooks's poem, you know, We Roll Cool, mm-hmm. We Skip School.
But it's very powerful.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And those How to Listen poems, every now and again, she'll have one that is commenting on the society around her, but they're largely concerned with her own growing ability to listen, which she places right at the center of a writer's project.
And I even think that one, though, the one that you read, mm-hmm. is very much about her ability to listen to the society around her.
Absolutely, right.
Yeah.
Sure.
One reviewer said that the title, Brown Girl Dreaming, was unfortunate. She thought the story was bigger, with a wider appeal. What do you think, Dana?
Yeah, it reminds me of this thing that Toni Morrison says when people ask her, is she ever going to write a white novel? And she says, well, I'm not going to be white. And you don't ask white writers if they're ever going to write a black novel. Why can't this brown girl have the title Brown Girl Dreaming?
Exactly.
Because the default position is, if it were just a girl dreaming, the point that Morrison was making was, unless we announce the character as black, the default position is white. So when she opens Paradise in, they shoot the white girl first, that's the only thing that we know, that there is actually a white girl in the story. The point is to deconstruct this notion that race matters. So with that default position, she has to put that in front. Otherwise, it's a white girl dreaming, and she's a brown girl and has the right, certainly, to be that, and to make the point that brown girls have universal stories as well.
Of course.
Right.
It's not my favorite title, but it has nothing to do with the fact that it's Brown Girl Dream.
Why?
I just might have preferred another title, but I'm not that good at titling things, so I should probably withhold my opinion.
I do think, though, that Woodson is very purposeful. And this is one of the things that I appreciated about her, even in the speech where there was this, you know, the acceptance of the book award. She's unapologetic. And I absolutely love that about her. She doesn't say, well, I'm just going to keep writing and making small changes so that I can get the awards. She stands her ground, still gets the award. And then, ironically, the award is sullied a little bit, still with this kind of, you know, racial moniker.
That's all for today. Our theme music is by Jim Brumberg and Ben Landsverk of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and me, Allison Brody. Our engineer this week was Natalie Yurov-Livker. Thanks for listening.